This is Jim Petrosini. Welcome to the Folksville Podcast. In our series of joint podcasts with Dr. Marv Langston and smartfuture.org, we'd like to introduce Scott Lee from the MITRE Corporation. Podcast number 10 will discuss the future of Department of Defense Command and Control Systems, the issues around the development of a joint all-domain command and control system. We will also discuss how new technologies will impact future systems and what the need for more user and operational input around the development of JADC2. This podcast was recorded on Friday, August 13th, 2021. Thank you. Good afternoon. This is Jim Petrosini along with Marv Langston in our continuing series with Smart Future and our webcast. This is episode number 10, but today we're honored to have Scott Lee from MITRE Corporation here. Scott, to start out, could you do a little introduction of yourself?
Sure, Jim. Marv, glad to be here this afternoon. So, Scott Lee, I'm the cross-cutting priority outcome lead for MITRE. I manage the Joint All-Domain Command and Control work that we have across the National Security Engineering Center, Federally Funded Research and Development Center, so the NSEC FFRDC. In terms of my background, I have a computer system engineering and military systems and operations analysis background. I've been doing C4ISR engineering and enterprise architecture support to various DoD entities for the past 30 years, now 21 of which those have been with MITRE. Just a little bit more about me. I began my career right out of college supporting what was then known as the Army Tactical Command and Control System. We were doing system engineering and integration support to that. And it really focused on trying to establish this thing back then called force level control, which was a construct that sought to link the battlefield functional area control systems like fires, air defense, intel, maneuver together. And so I think it's important if we look back at the mid-90s and force level control and ATICS and where we are today, that lots of parallel, lots of similarity, what we're trying to achieve with JADC2. So looking at that in terms of how do we bridge this diverse distributed force in terms of functionality, data, the enabling communications and supporting IT. Similar problems we had back then, we still face today. Over.
Yeah, I think the Navy had a thing called ForceNet in 15 years ago. And we all wonder if it's like back to the future.
Roger, I do remember ForceNet.
Marv, any thoughts on from your view on command and control in the future?
Well, it's what you both just said. We've been working on this problem now for 40 years, and it continues to get, I guess the good news is it gets more operational support and senior military support as a need, but that doesn't necessarily translate it into budget numbers that really compete against the weapon systems and platform systems. So once again, we're going to see how the JADC2 evolves, but it'll be interesting discussion to learn what Scott's doing with the JADC2.
Yeah, and just full disclosure, Scott and I met at the JADC2 conference in, I think it was the second week of July down at Texas A&M, a great three-day session, lots of senior leadership there, lots of good conversation from industry. And but I guess, one of the thoughts was, and we actually had a congressman from Massachusetts speak, but is there a perception issue with Congress who funds the Department of Defense that they understand platforms, but this world of command and control is a little fuzzy, or just is it an education issue or a knowledge issue? What do you think, Scott?
That's a really good question, Jim. I think when we look at what Joint All Domain Command and Control seeks to address, and the messaging that's behind it and its genesis in this idea of sensor to shooters and all domain effects convergence, I think the message in terms of improving command and control has gotten lost. Some might say that the Joint Staff J6 with a networks and cyber focus was probably the wrong place to put a command and control focused cross-functional team. At the same time, I think the services have been jockeying back and forth in terms of who's going to take on the leadership role for JADC2, with some believing that as a modernization priority across the DoD, that there's going to be ultimately some sort of joint program with a funding line associated with it. So lots of jockeying to be the lead for that if it was to become a joint program. And I think Congress has gotten a little bit lost in terms of what is JADC2. You know, they've been very focused on lethality. They've been looking at the service initiatives, whether that be Overmatch, Project Convergence, or ABMS. And they see lots of exploration with technologies and demonstrations of capability. But I think what gets lost and what's not articulated well from the DoD is what's the operational requirement that we're trying to address? What are the shortfalls, warfighting gaps associated with C2 that we have to overcome in order to be successful in competition and conflict against our peer adversaries?
Yeah, let me just add to that a little bit. I listened recently to General Keaton, the Vice JCS, who is the Air Force General, and a very, very interesting discussion. He was talking at the NDIA Experimental or Innovation Technology Institute they just started. And he made the point early in his talk that we lose the war games we play right now against our potential adversaries because they know all about how to cut off our information flow, and that information, without that information flow, we can't function as a military capability. And then he spent the rest of his talk talking about how he's trying to speed that up and change it. But to go back to the Congress for a second, I think it's more than just Congress not understanding it. I think they've never seen us produce anything very useful for the money we spend.
That's a really good point too. I think, the ABMS program executed 4 or 5 technology on-ramps. They were dinged by the GAO in terms of, hey, what's the operational requirement? What's the need you're trying to address? And I think Congress's reaction to that was, sort of a 50% budget cut in FY21 to ABMS, which forced them into a realignment, a reflection in terms of, okay, what are we trying to achieve? And they're much more focused now on acquisition strategy, and they've got a signed ABMS campaign plan from the Chief Staff Air Force, General Brown. So I think they're trying to address some of those concerns as well. But it remains a little bit muddled as you look at the various services.
You remember the NECC program that DISA was running?
I do.
Command and control across all the services. That was a big, 3 or 4 year failure?
I think we've got a history of that. If we look at not only NECC, but also Joint Command and Control as a successor to the GEECS that was started in the mid-2000s. So we've got this history, even not only at the joint level, but also within the services. I mean, the Army's still licking its wounds from the Future Combat System fiasco and still trying to address some of the gaps that it had back then.
Yeah. One of the way I kind of look at it is, and they mentioned like JADC2 is not a program of record. So don't expect, a large acquisition program. So, industry realizes that, but if anything, it's a catalyst to force the services to start doing new stuff, going faster. And, you on a positive, you hope that something will come out of it, They'll either resurrect something and make it better, or they'll really take AI. And I'm going to take one of the questions at Texas A&M was, we've got too many networks. So if we're really going to share data across the various services, why don't we stop using networks to secure our information and come up with some newer technology like data labeling, or, all be on the same network, but we secure things through, role-based acquisition or attribute-based acquisition.
Yeah, access control.
Yeah.
No, I absolutely agree. I think as we look at advancing next generation command and control, I think it's important to say we are in a data-centric warfare environment, and data is a strategic asset. And how do we protect that, and how do we access and exploit that at the speed and scale required to be successful? And at the same time, counter the adversary's ability to do the same to us. And in RBAC, role-based access is important. Identity credential access management is important. How do we bake that into a zero trust architecture for security of this operational environment we're trying to create is imperative. Would also say that it's important to decouple that data from systems and decouple systems from networks. So loosely coupled, decoupled constructs. Some might call that federation, but that's the integration approach I think we have to pursue to protect the data and to present a much more diverse posture for the adversary.
So everybody knows, and all these senior leaders, going back to General Keaton for a second, they're all talking about we've got to radically change the speed at which we acquire and field things. And Congress has done a great job of helping us with OTA contracts to try and speed that up, going straight from successful OTA prototypes to full production with sole source contracts. All of that helps us move in the right direction, and the leaders say the right things. But the antibodies inside the department continue to slow it back down because the contracting officers don't want to be cut out. So they keep adding FAR clauses back into the OTAs. The security restrictions we put on everything we do for the development process ensure basically that the productivity level is almost zero relative to what the productivity level is for commercial software development activities, which is where our leaders want us to go, but we don't end up getting there because of the way we slow things down. At least that's what I see. I don't know how you see that, Scott.
I see it similarly. I think OTAs have shown a lot of promise. And from an Army perspective, the synthetic training environment has been sort of successful pursuing OTA constructs as they seek to create the next generation of training capabilities for the Army. The RADAR funds that Deputy Secretary of Defense Hicks has put out there, I think that is an avenue to incentivize collaborative development of JADC2 concepts, capabilities going forward. So I think there's promise there. And I think that ends up being where we have to go from an acquisition or budgeting perspective is how do we incentivize collaborative development? How do we foster this unity of effort and clarity of purpose that we desire for JADC2? That ultimately means that I've got to have thought leadership within the OSD, within the Pentagon, not just sort of technical leadership across the JADC2 technology lines of effort, but you know, who's going to stand up and be that thought leader that takes the guide on and charges the hill and says, follow me and let's execute these RADAR funds to get there and show incremental progress. You mentioned DevSecOps, software platforms, software factories. Those have tremendous promise, tremendous operational benefit and utility to our warfighters. The idea of continuous development, continuous integration to generate mission-focused apps that act upon distributed data sets in that common data fabric and act upon the data analytics, the artificial intelligence and machine learning that I can bring to bear on that data in real time is what we have to have if we're going to be successful. And so lots of folks are talking about dynamic ops as the new norm and moving away from deliberate planning and on-call dynamic action. You know, to get there, we've got to have the DevSecOps platforms. We've got to be working in concert to get applications out there focused on mission needs. And we've got to get after how we connect this distributed data environment within this fabric and apply the analytics to it to make sense, visualize, and understand with purpose to be successful.
So, Scott,
is the Jake helping that at all, Scott?
So, I think the Jake is moving in the right direction. I think each of the services also have AI initiatives that are underway. Army Futures Command, for instance, has got an AI task force or an AI element that they're working with Carnegie Mellon. I know the Navy is looking at AI as well for overmatching for the Naval Operational Architecture. And the Air Force is looking at the application of AI to improve its effects chain execution and decisions. So it's important, though, if we look at what's going on out there, how do we harness all these various efforts? How do we focus them on need? And I saw recently where Army Futures Command released a sort of a top five or top eight research areas for artificial intelligence. And that's where we got to go is where do we see the gaps, the opportunities for application of AI and other advanced analytics on data? And how do we experiment, explore that together in a collaborative environment to move it forward and make sure that we're doing that in terms of the scale necessary to overcome complexity in one service? So best of breed solutions aren't necessarily the answer for all the services, but I think collaboration, development of AI-focused solutions that get after that data, that get after how I'm improving or enabling command and control or course of action generation, or how I'm improving threat detection, anomaly detection within the battlespace environment. You know, there's goodness there that we can leverage across the services and across the combatant commands.
Yeah, you had a great, when you briefed at the JADC2 conference, you had a great, kind of a new idea of around the common operational picture. And, you know, the legacy mindset is every battle group commander or senior officer wants to see the COP, right? And you had kind of a new idea. So maybe could you kind of throw out your ideas on what the new COP is or mini COP?
Absolutely. I think, and so when we looked at for where we are today, and we can look back for 20, 25 years or so, there's been this desire to create this all-encompassing global common operational picture in a complementary common intel picture, and then some sort of supporting common tactical pictures. At the end of the day, what each of those seeks to do is harness all data all the time, everywhere, and throw it on a map or throw it on some display so the commander can say, yep, there's my forces, there's my equities, there's the enemy. It's a cluttered view that doesn't provide relevance or allow the commander to act upon anything that's being presented to him or her in terms of the displays. So as we look at the common operational picture moving forward, we really believe that a paradigm shift is necessary. And perhaps we even drop the term COP and SIP and CTP altogether, start talking about these ideas like mission-driven joint all-domain awareness, visualization, and understanding. And that mission-driven aspect is based on contextual need. As I spin up a mission and I create a C2 construct to help me execute that mission, I understand or I document the contextual needs that I have for that mission, those data attributes, and that's what I seek to address. And I look out there at that diverse or that distributed data environment, that data fabric, and I start bringing in data that meets those attributes based on my mission contextual need. And I'm applying analytics and automation to those data feeds and analytics and automation to my operational workflows within the command and control so that I am now visualizing and understanding a picture with purpose based upon what I have to do to achieve my mission. And so if I apply modeling and simulation capabilities to that picture as well, that allows me to start seeing the current situation, the projected future situation, gaps and opportunities, strengths and weaknesses from both a blue and a red perspective. And I can start to play out what ifs in terms of machine generated courses of action or option recommendations for the commander. So that's where we see the community going, is this idea of mission driven awareness that's spatially and temporally visualized with purpose based on automation and the application analytics to that contextual data set.
And does that need to come from a fleet end user that drives that? I kid, we've gone from like the COP 20 years ago to now everybody just chats and it kind of ignores everything else. Right. And there's 50 chat windows and that's how they do everything, right? So there's somewhere in the middle, but do we really need to get more end user input and end user feedback as part of, instead of just the acquisition blob that tries to determine all this stuff?
Jim, that's a really good point. And I think, I had the opportunity to participate at Forager 21 in Guam with the Army's first multi-domain task force. And you still see that chat surfer is being used to pass orders and to pass targeting data and to send, tasks and fire missions downrange. And they've got four or five disparate displays because the four or five different command and control systems aren't sharing the same track data. So you don't have that common picture that everybody says they need, at least from an acquisition perspective. The operational user General Eisenhower, for instance, he was very articulate in describing what he wants to see in terms of a mission dashboard that's customizable and tailorable based upon the mission, based upon the target set that they are conducting reconnaissance and effects planning against for that given day. And so the user can provide us input into what needs to be displayed, what are those mission attributes that the data sets and the analytics have to address. And we can bring that in through automation and let the machine focus on the known data and allows us to then look at, okay, where are my data gaps? Where are those commanders' critical information requirements that I have to address? And then focus my collection on that. So that would ultimately speed up the entire process within the command center. But the user has to drive the requirements train here. And it's going to be dynamic in nature. We can't build a system that's based on this mission and expect that mission and its associated data set will persist for all time. We have to be adaptable and flexible so that as new data sets become available or as old data sets expire, that we are able to adjust the data pipeline and we're able to adjust the analytics and operational process based upon what we have access to.
Yeah, one of your points you're making, Scott, that I think makes a lot of sense is we keep talking about using AI for providing better operational recommendations to the commanders. But AI right now is a black box because we don't have explainable AI or general AI. But what it does do really well and can be very supportive in is taking those feeds, those sensor feeds, and parsing out the information that we're asking for, the operator's asking for, and making sure that that's the right stuff that gets through the maze of data that we're moving around and playing with to get to the right place at the right time. But I don't see a lot of work focused on that. Now, I don't know if the Jake's focused on it, and I don't know if JADC2's focused on it, but I know for sure that Overmatch is not focused on that.
Well, it's a really good point and question here, Mark. And so from MITRE's perspective, getting after what you just described, where can I apply AI today to make a difference? And so MITRE's got an internal and an Air Force partnered effort that we call Discovery at Scale, but we're trying to get after some of that. We're trying to get after strategic ISR, indications and warnings, tips, cues, and alerts based on a contextual search of a geographic area And we're using AI and the data, the automated data feeds coming in there to focus our resources on, you know, areas that we think a target, let's say, would pop up. So we're focusing on context where we think they are instead of focusing on a large, diverse geographic area. And so that allows us to search at scale, that allows us to speed up the process, that allows us to let the machine and the AI algorithms do a lot of searching and sorting through the data to then generate recommendations to the analyst in terms of where to focus collection assets for a given day. And that ISR perspective then would translate to a fire's perspective where we can do similar things. If a target pops up, the AI can rapidly look across the domain assets that are available for the commander to employ, both kinetic and non-kinetic, and it can generate a set of recommendations and prioritize those recommendations based upon algorithms that are looking at probability of kill, success, survivability, cost of the mission, the requirement for layered effects, and things like that.
Makes sense.
So Scott, do you see, you know, there's all these new technologies. Is it a case that there's just too much new technology and the fact that the commercial world's kind of overwhelmed the DoD that we get confused and it even makes worse, or the end users don't even understand any of this technology? So just, and you know, spin it on a positive, like what needs to be done to kind of, you know, should we have different pilots? It seems like the services are doing their own thing, but, you know, industry isn't really playing that much of a role at this point. So just want to get your thoughts on, you know, maybe the next 6 months to a year, 2 years, what you see happening.
Sure. So I think, you know, I think, I won't say blame's probably not the correct word here, but I think each side is sort of to blame. You know, industry is building some really cool capabilities, a lot of innovation that's occurring out there. You know, various companies are marketing joint all-domain command and control solutions to DoD. You know, and DoD is saying, looking at various technologies as the answer to all of its warfighting gaps, but really not taking the time to look at what are the true operational needs that I have in the future in terms of next generation warfighting or next generation C2. And then blaming industry for not bringing anything to the table that helps them answer something that they really haven't articulated yet. So I think it's both sides need to look, you know, sort of take this operational pause, if you will, and say, okay, if we're looking at next generation command and control, we need to focus on something tangible. And I think that tangible thing is decision dominance. And so if we look at the adversary, we look at where we're going, we have to achieve decision dominance to create the decision space, decision time within which we can act and we can deliver, you know, multiple dilemmas to the adversary, and we can win in terms of time, space, and purpose. To get to decision dominance, we've got to have and maintain and protect information advantage and deny that to the adversary, which means that I am dynamically executing this persistent operational process focused on sensing, understanding, deciding, acting, engaging, supporting, moving, and then assessing the status there and then going back into the sense of the environment to see how my actions have affected the adversary and so forth. And so we've got to focus on that, and how would the technologies that we're talking about out there enable us to create information advantage to the execution of that ops process? And how does that allow us to create decision dominance over the adversary? And so how does industry bring data fabrics, knowledge graphs, link analysis, you know, next generation data mesh architecture ideas to the table? How do we apply advanced analytics to that at speed and scale? How do we invest in coherent DevSecOps platforms instead of having 10, 20 that we're trying to integrate at the end of the day, so that we're creating agile applications that allow that mission-based awareness, understanding, visualization, and action that I talked about? How are we securing it? How are we providing access to that within the cloud all the way down to an edge platform node at the tactical edge? And what does that network construct look like at the future that you talked about? It can't be 5-10 different networks with a huge CDS architecture out there. It's going to be something a little bit more focused that includes mission secret releasability for our mission partners, and really needs to focus on machine-to-machine communication if we're going to integrate our sensors and effectors together at the edge, you know, past that core data. Don't look to pass all data all the time everywhere. And if we were to articulate what this vision is for the future and create some sort of operational concept of operation employment for that, I think the DoD and the Pentagon would be better able to discuss and describe to industry what it needs for the future. And industry would have a better perspective in terms of how its solutions might apply to that construct going forward. And I think that's where we are, Jim, is the strategic approach for JADC2 needs to really be focused, needs to be well understood by the community. And we need to sit down and establish partnerships between defense industry, The FFRDC is the UARCs and the academia base to get after incremental problem or incremental challenges moving this thing forward. We're not going to solve it, you know, comprehensively in the next 3 to 4 years, but we can start to solve priority gaps, incremental development that solves those gaps here in the next couple of years.
So Scott, no, the Navy is not, in the overmatch case, doing anything towards establishing prime contractors, getting the big industry contractors involved. We're really piecemealing it across small contractor bases, working with the system centers. Is it different in the Air Force? Are they doing something better towards lining up large contractors?
That's a really good question. I think part of, you know, I go back to really quick, part of the problem between defense, the joint staff, and the services, talking to industry too, is the messaging that's out there really confuses the entire debate or the entire discussion, where industry or the services may say, hey, I'm building JADC2 today as part of Project Overmatch. I mean, that came out at the Air Sea Space Conference here a couple of weeks ago, if not last week. And so you start peeling that back and say, well, no service is really building JADC2 today. And it's nothing even like what JADC2 seeks to be in the services. They're each addressing specific modernization gaps to fix themselves. And we'll worry about JADC2 at some end state in 2025, 2027 or later timeframe. The contracting piece is interesting, as you noted. I think the Air Force started out bringing in lots of technology vendors, lots of innovators out there. They were demonstrating capability at the on-ramps, but they weren't tying that back to requirements. And there was comments at the time from Air Force leadership that we don't need requirements. Requirements stifle innovation and agility. Well, I think you've got to have at least some sense of what's the mission, what's the mission-driven aspect you're trying to achieve. And that gets us back to that decision dominance discussion I just had a minute ago. But the Air Force is looking at some IDIQ contracts. I think there will be some larger contracts. I don't see it being sort of the prime approach that we've had in the past. And from an Army perspective, I think it's the same way. The Army's got 31 plus three initiatives within its internal cross-functional teams that it's using to pursue solutions to project convergence, which really is more than JADC2. It's really all about Army modernization writ large. And C2 or network improvements is just a small part of that. So the acquisition strategies, the modernization strategies to get after JADC2 is a weak link if we look at the services from my humble position.
That's really interesting what you're saying, because I would assume that the Air Force was moving more towards their continuation of large primes, which has been sort of their tradition. But if all of the services are trying to do this along IDIQ kind of contracts and tasking contracts, that begs the question of where do we do the system engineering to actually make this stuff come together? And I have heard senior captains in the Navy tell me that they don't think this kind of stuff needs very much system engineering anymore. It sort of goes together by itself. I happen to disagree with that, but I have heard them say that.
Yeah, on the Air Force, Marv, you know, ABMS had several IDIQ awards, but very little task orders in 2021. Right. I mean, COVID had some effect on it, but you know, the idea that as a big prime, you're going to get, you know, out of a $400 million IDIQ, you're going to get, you know, $25 million. I think everybody's realizing that's not happening. And the ABMS budget, I think, got split in half from like $350 million or $300 million to like $160 million. So that was some of the discussions earlier about the Congress just didn't understand what ABMS was. And again, more, we got to educate people on what this what command and control is, right? As opposed,
I think the engineering integration question there. I think that's interesting. I mean, there is a belief that if I just use, say, the DoD platform one, that all system engineering integration is just going to take care of itself, and you know, magic's going to happen. There's a big belief in certain circles about, you know, engineering integration is going to occur if I just use DevSecOps or if I use this, that, or the other. I think ultimately, though, for JADC2 to be successful, we've got to focus on and invest in somehow, you know, that holistic systems engineering and integration, both horizontally and vertically, through the forces, through the services, through the combatant commands, with our mission partners, and through the intelligence community. It's not going to happen on its own. I don't think that requires us to have sort of a large systems integrator like a Boeing was on FCS. But we do need to figure out how do we get after the SE&I problem with JADC2 in its current state. And that does require, back to the leadership question, I think OSD R&E and OSD A&S exerting more leadership from the OSD perspective down into the services and providing some direction. And I think with Ms. Hsu coming in now as the R&E, I think there's opportunity, at least from an FFRDC perspective, where she's going to look at the FFRDCs to come together, work together as one, partner with industry, and start tackling and advancing JADC2 step by step going forward and do that system engineering and integration role that has to be done.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I was thinking about while you were talking, the SDIO, when it first started up, that really brought all the FFRDCs together, because I was working at Applied Physics Lab during that period of time, and we were working with all the aerospace and the MITRs and everybody else across the system to help bring together system concepts that could be applied across that whole domain. And I think you can argue that we haven't succeeded completely because of the toughness of the challenge, but I think they did make a lot of progress, but of course they also spent a lot of money, which we don't tend to do on the command and control side.
Yeah, I think that might be a good further discussion. Like, is it going to be like the Aegis program where they hire an integrator to do it? Is it going to be like what we did with JOTS, where a small business just rode ships and we actually had, you know, end user fleet people drive the requirments?
I think one thing we've talked about, one thing I've advocated for at least, was sort of that ladder, Jim, was how do we create data science software innovation teams that we put out there in the operational user base so that we are addressing, you know, user needs, warfighting needs on a more dynamic basis, and we're not necessarily having to rely on a DevSecOps platform and CONUS to do all the work, but we've got some sort of forward instantiation that's enabling that real-time support.
Yeah, the General Murray comment about having programmers.
Right.
You know, and again, 30 years ago, we had programmers at sea. And so I kind of said we should have a USS DevSecOps and have a float platform that we could, you know, the end user fleet guys are right there telling the developer what to do.
Yep. I think some of if you were to look back at things like Tiger in Iraq, and those applications, those capabilities were successful because they had the software developers there that were making changes at night based on what the patrol saw during the day. And that flexibility, agility is what we got to have.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I also wanted to touch back on your point about the AI task force that the Air Force is using. I know in the Navy, we've got several task forces set up. And what I am encouraged by on these task forces is they actually provide a direct connection between the operational folks and the development implementation folks. So it's sort of an IPT like activity that's trying to get everybody together to think through it and talk about it at the same time. Now, how we translate that into product will be interesting to see going forward.
I agree. I think, but that, you know, that will take off some of the just sprinkle AI here, there, and everywhere, and we're going to solve world hunger, or we're going to solve all the C2 and some of the shooter problems. I think you've got to focus it on what are the key gaps, opportunities that you want to apply AI and other advanced data analytics against, because at the end of the day, it's math. And I think that's important for people to know that we're talking about mathematics acting on data to discern knowledge and present that knowledge to the commander to alleviate sort of the cognitive burden and to illuminate things that he or she might not have seen, looking at the data set or looking at the mission-driven awareness that's being displayed to them. And those task forces need to leverage the expertise that's out there in academia and in the FFRDC and work together, the partnerships. And I think that's where the JAIC is trying to go as well. I know that the JADC2 cross-functional team has tasked MITRE to look at AI initiatives across the DoD landscape, if you will, and see where there may be opportunities to bring some of those tasks together to get after common problems.
So Scott, to wrap up, maybe 30 seconds to a minute, what in the next, say, 3 to 6 months would you like to see, whether it's webinars to educate more end users, to get a fleet working group or an end user working group? What are your kind of closing thoughts, which we could maybe push down for a few further discussion?
I agree. I think so. What I'd like to see is go back to the strategic approach, discussion. And yes, I recognize that there is a JADC2 strategy that Secretary of Defense Austin signed on 13 May, but I think we've got to really focus the message or the initiatives and the effort out there on a specific end state, if you will. What's that target we're trying to get after? And I think it's all about decision dominance again. How are we getting after decision dominance and information advantage across the services, because each service talks about that in their various initiatives, but no one's really diving into it. And so as we look at the service chiefs, you know, they met at Aberdeen Proving Ground on the 8th of April. You know, the CNO, the CSAF, the chief staff of the Army all met at Aberdeen, and they talked about JADC2, and they talked about the need to create a common operational construct, a common strategic approach to JADC2 that would show each service's contributions and delineate where there were gaps, where there may be overlaps that needed to be addressed as they engage Congress and they engage the Joint Staff and OSD to talk about how they're moving forward. And so if we were to look back on how do we create that common construct, how do we create that common shared vision of JADC2, focusing on decision dominance, information advantage, and a dynamic ops process, and how do we apply these critical enabling technologies that we talked about to enable that? That's, to me, where I would start. You know, what are the working groups we can create to get after that across the community? How would we get industry involved in shaping those events and talking about how they could contribute to those? And we can start identifying areas for collaborative experimentation, for modeling, simulation, analytics in an open, shared environment. And to me, that helps us explore, mature, and advance C2 concepts more rapidly than we have today.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, thanks everyone for the session. Look forward to further discussions, and everybody have a good weekend.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Scott.